Climate change is coming, and it's affecting everyone. And the evidence of it is already visible here in the Cook Inlet region, our waters and in our wildlife. And that's going to be our topic today on Hometown Alaska. I'm Charles Woolforth. I spent quite a bit of time writing about climate change. I was thinking back on it, maybe 15 years. And in some ways, nothing's changed in terms of we're still having some international talks to do something about it. But in other ways, a lot has changed. There's a lot more solid evidence. And now we can talk about the changes in the environment that are actually occurring rather than just speculating about them. And for that purpose, I have three experts on with me today who can really dig into climate change and what it looks like in the Cook Inlet region, in the waters, and in the wildlife. And also talk a little bit about the projections for the future. And we're going to welcome your questions as well. If you have questions about our environment and what we're seeing through these changes, this is a great hour for you to be on the air with us. So I'll be giving those phone numbers out in a minute. But first, I want to introduce my guests. On the phone with me is Nancy Fresco, who is a research professor, University of Alaska Fairbanks, and she's also the network coordinator for something called the Scenarios Network for Alaska and Arctic Planning, which is a system that you can look at online and look at your own area, look at exactly where you are, and find out what the climate models predict. And we'll talk more about that later in the show. Thanks for being with us, Nancy.
Well, thanks very much for having me.
John Morton is also with us on the phone from Soldotna. He's the supervisory biologist with the Kenai National Wildlife Refuge and has been involved in numerous national panels working on climate change as it affects the national wildlife refuges, as it affects Kenai Peninsula, and also as it affects the entire country. Thanks for being with us, John.
Sure, thanks. Appreciate it.
And in the studio, just off the road from Homer, is Sue Mauger, who is the science director for the Cook Inlet Keeper. Thanks for being with us, Sue.
Happy to be here. Thanks, Charles.
So you started quite a while ago looking at climate change impacts on the Kenai Peninsula. And, of course, the Kenai Peninsula is synonymous with salmon. And sort of that's kind of where you started looking. Tell us a little bit about the research you did in streams and trying to measure impacts.
Sure. So I came to the Kenai Peninsula in 2000, and my job was to collect some information in our local salmon streams down on the lower Kenai Peninsula, so the Inca River and the Nilchik River, streams like that, and see what was going on because the forest had just died. The spruce bark beetle infestation had peaked, and people were in a little bit of post-traumatic stress syndrome state from all of the trees that were dead, and started to really wonder what that meant for the salmon streams.
Sort of what's next?
Yeah.
What's the next shoe to fall?
And what does it mean if your forest dies, you know, for the watershed? And so we were collecting a lot of water quality information. And what I discovered, and wasn't really at all looking for it, I was new to Alaska, and what I was really surprised by was how warm the streams were in July, and I really didn't have any way to gauge whether that was typical or not. And so, of course, I was like, well, gosh, yeah, maybe the death of the forest really has warmed up these streams. And so we put in these data loggers that collected information every 15 minutes and started to learn more about the patterns of temperature in the stream. And what we ultimately found was that the stream was warm for the same reason that the bark beetle infestation happened, and that it was warmer and drier summers, and that we had a lot less water in the river, and the air temperatures and the solar radiation hitting the stream was much greater, and the streams were warmer. And so,
what does that mean for fish when there's less water and it's warmer in the stream?
Right. So salmon are cold water fish. They like temperatures generally below about 55 degrees Fahrenheit. And so I was starting to see temperatures that were around 65, 68. And so that's getting up to really stressful temperatures for them. They don't, they aren't able to put as much weight on as a juvenile. They are more stressed as they're moving upstream. They're a lot more susceptible to predation and susceptible to diseases, and also more sluggish, so they can their ability for their body to handle toxins and pollution is much diminished. So really vulnerable at warmer temperatures. So we started. The next question, of course, is, okay, so are these streams special? Are they warmer than everywhere else or not? And so we started to look around for other data sets, and we're surprised to really not find many that we
really...
In other
words, it hadn't been well studied.
No. Everyone, I think, assumed we're in Alaska. It's cold water fish, no problem. And so we began with 4 streams and then bumped it out to 48 streams to get us some understanding of what the patterns were all across Cook Inlet.
So that was almost 15 years ago. Have you seen a pattern?
Well, what we've found is that there are certain streams that warm. If we have a warm summer, the streams are warm. But we also have streams that stay quite cool, regardless of the air temperature patterns.
That's good news.
And so, yeah, so that range was great to see. And it's a real reflection of our landscape and the different types of systems that we have. And so streams that stay cold often are very affected by groundwater. So there's really good cold water connections to keep them colder all year round. And then other systems that don't have that connection are very sensitive to increasing air temperatures. So we have a range of those systems, which means our salmon are experiencing a range of conditions
right.
in their natal streams.
And as the climate warms, presumably we'll see trends and see these streams react differently. So that's our topic today, folks. That sort of gives you a taste of what we're going to be talking about over the next hour. If you have questions for our experts, or who an expert on the water, an expert on the land, and then an expert on the modeling, please join us. The phone number here is 550-8433, 550-8433. Outside Anchorage, the number is 888-353-5752. Email is a great way to get on the air, especially with a topic like this one that can be a little bit challenging, hometown@alaskapublic.org, with your questions or comments. My next guest is John Morton. He's a supervisory biologist at the Kenai National Wildlife Refuge and has been deeply immersed in the climate change issue here and all over the country in being involved in different panels studying it. John, there's been... I guess people have known for a long time now that, our spruce beetle infestation seems to have been a climate change impact because although spruce bark beetles were around, before, they didn't ever spread though, like until they hit this series of warm spring times. What other kinds of climate change impacts have you seen in the National Wildlife Refuge?
Well, one of the... I think one of the reasons we know so much about the spruce bark beetle here, of course, is that we had Dr. Ed Berg, who is the ecologist here at the Kenai National Wildlife Refuge for 20 years. And during that time, he did lots of the seminal research here on climate change on the Kenai Peninsula, including looking at fire regime and spruce bark beetle outbreaks. And it's because of a lot of his work that we know so much. And he's been... Some of the things I'll be talking about right now very quickly are lots of these things are things that Ed has been involved in one way, shape, or another, often co-authoring papers with different individuals. But at any rate, some of the things that we do know about, for instance, available water, and this ties in very nicely with what Sue Marger was talking about, but available water on the Kenai Peninsula. And by available water, what I mean is... the water that's available after you take out, evapotranspiration, and the because of the increasing temperatures, is we've had a 60% decline in available water on the Kenai Peninsula since 1968.
Wow, that's incredible. That's a huge number.
That's a huge number. The wetlands have been drying at the rate of 6 to 11% in surface acreage per decade since 1950. Our glaciers, as you know, have been receding, and depending on what you look at, I think this is a little bit dated, but the Harding Ice Field, which is the largest ice field, wholly within U.S. Borders, since 1950 has lost about 5% of its surface area and about 60 feet in elevation on average.
Gosh.
So, and of course, lots of folks know, I mean, it's why President Obama went to Exit Glacier, because it's so iconic that the Exit Glacier has been receding over a extended window, but it seems to be accelerating. Tree line has risen about a meter per decade about a meter per year over the last 50 years. And it doesn't sound like a lot because it's only about 50 meters over the last 50 years. But the reality, we're talking about the Kenai Mountains here, is if you actually follow that line, that tree line rise in the GIS, you know, we're talking about 300,000 acres of alpine tundra lost.
And I remember talking to Ed Berg about that, that you go down into certain spots where you would go to tree line and you'd see these Krumholtz trees, mountain hemlock trees that were all gnarled and had grown that way for very, very long time. And then they started to shoot straight up and grow straight and tall because the tree line had moved up the mountain.
Yeah, exactly. These Krumholtz, you know, are the trees right at tree line that are actually growing more horizontal to the ground. But then in this rising, you know, tree line and warming climate, they actually start to go vertical like a tree should. So you kind of get this L-shaped tree, which is very strange to see.
Yeah, yeah. But probably can see that in the Chugach Mountains here in Anchorage too. I haven't actually looked, but I would bet so. Yeah. So go on, John.
Well, you know, and you mentioned earlier the spruce bark beetle outbreaks. I mean, the real key there, I think you mentioned that, we have had spruce bark beetle outbreaks. And if you look at some of the research that Ed's done, it's been, on average, historically, we've had a spruce bark beetle every 50 years. And the one that we had that started here on the Kenai Peninsula in the 1980s and went for, you know, all through the 90s for about 15 years. It's arguably the longest running spruce bark beetle outbreak in North American history. And, you know, it ended up consuming about 4 million acres of trees in South Central Alaska. And the key there is that what Ed figured out through his dendrochronology research was that what triggers a spruce bark beetle outbreak roughly every 50 years is two consecutive summers of above-average temperatures. And, of course, what we had in the 90s were multiple summers of, you know, a series of summers of above-average temperatures, and so it kept driving it through this period. Some of the other things we're beginning to see here, too, is, it's a little premature for us to be saying there's been a change in wildfire regimes, because you have to realize that when we talk about fire regimes, we tend to talk about mean fire return intervals. And for, you know, trees down here on the Kenai, for black spruce, we're talking about, you know, 80 years. And in the case of white spruce, we're talking about, hundreds of years. So obviously not that much time has passed. So, obviously difficult to say that this stuff is the fires regime has shifted that mm-hmm. much here on the Kenai. But what's very compelling that's the case is because of we now have spring fires in grassland, which is something that we historically have not had. And it's because of some of the early fires here on the Kenai Peninsula that the state of Alaska moved the start of the official fire season from May 1 to April 1, and that was specifically in response to the Tracy Avenue fire that we had down here on the Kenai Peninsula.
And so is that because of lack of snow cover, and so the ground is just getting really, really dry much earlier in the year?
Well, it's a combination, really, of the aftermath of the beetle kill, because when we had this, and certainly in the southern part of the peninsula, we had this very dramatic 100% tree mortality. And in the absence of that tree cover, blue joint grass, which is Calamagrostis canadensis, which is this grass, it's a native grass. It's always there. It's all over the Kenai Peninsula. But what happened in the aftermath of losing the forest cover is that it just took off and got very, very thick. And the problem here on the Kenai, of course, is that now it's taken quite a while for the trees to begin regenerating, and so we have this very lush grass that tends to be very dry in the spring, you know, after the snow cover comes off, and there's that short period there in April and May before we actually start getting rain in between the snow melt and rain where it really dries out and it's very, very flammable.
Yeah. So I want to get back to you, John, and talk more about these impacts and also talk about wildlife impacts, but I wanted to bring in my next guest as well, Nancy Fresco. Nancy's a research professor at University of Alaska Fairbanks, and she's a network coordinator for a really interesting program called the Scenarios Network for Alaska and Arctic Planning. I became aware of her work last year when I was looking at the climate change impacts for skiers for the other show I do, Outdoor Explorer. Skiing's important too, might not be as important as the stuff we're talking about. And the work I did, I just had a huge impact. I just received so much feedback from it because people were so excited to hear some hard information about what these future scenarios are for our area and what really might be happening a generation or half a generation in the future. And in fact, today's show is a result of a listener request when we were soliciting listeners to find out what they wanted to hear about. So, Nancy, I want to thank you again for being with us. And I wonder if you would explain briefly how your program works in terms of making climate change predictions for fairly small scale, fairly local areas. How do you go about doing that?
Sure. We deal with an enormous amount of data, but we try to make that data as useful and as accessible to the people who really need it as we can. And so, in fact, I've been lucky enough to work at different times with both Sue and John, the other guests on this show. And that's kind of the core of what we try to do. The Scenarios Network for Alaska and Arctic Planning is conveniently abbreviated to SNAP. We're up here at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, but we work collaboratively with groups, programs, communities, individuals all over the state and, in fact, across the border in parts of Northwest Canada as well.
And you come up with these predictions for areas where you can almost drill down on a map and say what's going to happen in this town and what's going to happen in that town. And I was surprised that that was possible.
Well, that's what we try to make possible. We take some very broad-scale models. They're global circulation models, so they're predictive climate outputs for the whole world. And then we downscale them using gridded climate data that comes from a group called PRISM. Basically, what we're doing is trying to take these big global models and make them meaningful at the local level, using the PRISM model, which takes into account all the variability of slopes and elevation and how far you are from a known climate station, how far you are from the coast, so that we can bring this information down to, you know, not quite the level of your backyard, but a pretty fine scale. And for those who are interested in getting online and looking at our website, you can actually create a little graph from a tool on our website that will allow you to look at a particular community.
Let's walk through that, because on our website at alaskapublic.org, if listeners are on the computer right now, or if you can get on it later and maybe listen to us again by streaming through the website, you go to alaskapublic.org and click on today's show, Climate Change and Cook Inlet, and scroll down and you'll see a link for Scenarios Network for Alaska and Arctic Planning, SNAP, and I'm clicking on it right now. And then and then where would we go from there, Nancy, in terms of like learning about our local spot, where we are?
Sure. Well, one tool that's pretty accessible to a range of users, if you look at the top where it says SNAP and then there's some drop-down menus, one of them says Tools plus Data.
Got it.
And if you click on that, you get a little drop-down menu, and where I went is the second spot down that says Community Charts.
I see it. Uh-huh.
That's a nice, accessible tool. What's great about it is that you can...
I can type in the name of my town here.
Yeah. Once you've opened up Community Charts, you have the freedom to type in the name of any community in Alaska or Western Canada, and that could be a community of 20 people or it could be Anchorage. It doesn't matter. I just went ahead and typed in English Bay, and it finishes. If you don't know how to spell what you're typing, it finishes it for you, which is helpful.
That's helpful. And I
popped up a simple predictive chart showing average monthly temperature for English Bay, Alaska. And there are a lot of choices in here, and it's a fun tool to play with. But what this does is it takes raw data that isn't necessarily super exciting or meaningful, and it turns it into something you can look at on your screen and really think about.
So looking at this right now, I can see a bar for sort of the current time frame, what the temperature would be during the month of October, and then I could look at the bar for 2040 to 49, 2060 to 69, or 2090 to 99, and see how what the temperature would be predicted at that time. And there's a lot of other things you could look at here too in terms of precipitation and also whether you're going to look at a high range, middle range, or low range. Really interesting stuff, and I would recommend people sort of dig into this. You'll learn a lot, as I did when I was studying it. So using this information, Nancy, are you able to sort of work with Sue and John and say, if Sue says, well, this creek seems to be particularly susceptible to warming water, then kind of start to make some predictions about that particular creek?
Exactly. And that is why all our projects are collaborative, because what we have is a huge amount of data on historical current and predicted air temperature precipitation. But what we need is information coming from folks like Sue, who's been out there measuring water temperature and coming up with these useful rules in this deeper level of understanding about how for some streams the water temperature is very closely linked to the air temperature, and for some it's not. And so by working with groups like Cook Inlet Keeper and so forth, we can share our information and say, okay, for those streams that have a close connection with air temperature, our air temperature predictions might be very useful to you. But all of our numbers, all of our data are useful in the context of the knowledge that people have on the ground.
Right. Combination of human being and computer, and we start to get some answers. It's Hometown Alaska. I'm Charles Woolforth. We're talking today about climate change and Cook Inlet. And the tools we were just talking about are at alaskapublic.org. Click on today's show, Climate Change and Cook Inlet, and you'll find a link to SNAP, what Nancy's talking about in terms of finding detailed information on projections. And also there's a link there to an article I wrote last year in the Anchorage Press that talks about the impacts for skiing that Nancy was a huge help with. And we'd welcome your questions and get involved in our conversation. The number here is 550-8433, 550-8433. Outside Anchorage, 888-353-5752. And the email is hometown@alaskapublic.org. And now I'd kind of like to throw it out to a roundtable with our guests. I think something that's much on the minds of all Alaskans is the really weird year we had in 2014, and now we're going into another winter that may be unusual, since we're apparently having a historically strong El Nino effect. And I just wanted to get a sense from the three of you, what kind of impacts you were able to see in the land and in the water, and then how that reflected sort of what we would expect in terms of a future scenario from Nancy. Sue, in looking at your streams, did you see really high water temperatures because of the seemingly abnormally warm temperatures we had?
Yeah, we did have some streams that were very high. And interestingly, when I started, I thought that the story was all about just what the summer air temperatures were and that it was all a summer story. And it really is so influenced by what our winters are doing. And our winters are actually warming faster than our summers. And so when we have low snow pack in the wintertime, that basically is all of our river water that's stored on the hillsides for us in the summer. And if we do not have that snowpack, then we have very little water in the rivers in the summertime. And so when you add a warm summer with a warm winter, you end up with warm temperatures and very little water. And a little bit of water warms much faster than a lot of water. So, yes, we had very warm conditions in our streams and, in fact, had a number...
It was a big fish kill, wasn't there?
There were a number of rivers that we saw fish dying before they were able to spawn. There was some reports down in Soldovia. When you have pink salmon, you often can get a big slug of them caught in the estuary with low water conditions. Mm-hmm. And I think those fish may have been affected by, they got stranded from low water volume, as opposed to, I'm sure the temperatures didn't help, but that low water was a big deal.
Right. And then, listeners who listen to the show often know that I spend my summers on Ketchikan Bay, and we've had our creeks dry up for the first time in anyone's memory.
Really? Yeah. Yep. So we are seeing some really new conditions on the landscape. We had places in the Mat-Su Basin, which are always like the Deshka River, which is still a wonderful salmon stream, but it gets quite warm. And this summer was no exception, where the fish biologists could see the fish holding below the mouth, waiting to move up until the conditions got a little bit cooler. They were waiting for a slug of rain that would cool the river a little bit. And so I think that we're at the stage where we're seeing the fish behaving differently because of these warmer conditions.
Are you able to link that to escapement and the probability of returns in the future?
Not yet. I think that's something that we all imagine will work towards, but salmon life history is very complicated, which is why they are such a successful species. They have lots of different strategies to deal with poor year conditions, and so we have a long way in our understanding of where they go within the watershed to spawn and to rear, and then we also have a whole new understanding we need to gain in where the heck they go in the ocean.
So much change,
yeah.
and a complex system. Yeah. Right. So, John, from the point of view of the forest and the wildlife refuge, I mean, we've had some monster fires this last summer. Any other, and I assume that was probably related to the low snowpack. What other kinds of changes did you see, particularly related to this extreme year that we just had?
Well, one of the more interesting ones that got a lot of press time down here in the local paper here was we had an undergraduate intern named Mariah Stevens, and we brought, and this summer one of her major project that she worked on was to put a bird automated bird recording device out there in different parts of the refuge, and that was to kind of look at bird singing chronology or phenology over the spring. And the purpose of it was specifically to look to see if the time of peak singing has changed, and it has. And that's the thing that's so that's pretty interesting, because we've always, based on there's a statewide bird survey group called Alaska Land Bird Monitoring Survey, and we follow their standardized protocols. And typically, we've done most of our bird surveys in the last 3 weeks of June, and that's been sort of the long-term, standard for doing bird surveys. But this past spring, when we tracked this, we looked at seven different species, and we tracked this. And what was really fascinating was that it actually peaked at the end of May, and the first week of June. So we were actually at least, if we had done it when we normally did it, we would have shown a change in bird numbers based on bird calls, when in reality it was just that they were calling before we ever got out there.
Huh.
And so that's, and that's an interesting piece, because we use bird surveys as a way to detect changes in things like climate change, that are resulting from climate change, and yet the very surveys that we use are now a little bit suspect.
Such a complex system. Do we know why the birds were early? Was it they are keying off when the snow melts, or their eggs hatch early, or is that just a bunch of guesswork?
No, they're primarily driven by photo period. So that's kind of a fixed piece. That's sort of the ultimate driver. But their proximate drivers, they're very temperature dependent.
Hmm.
So it's a combination of things. One, I mean, the migrants got up here sooner, I think, than normal, simply because the lakes were open at least a month earlier than they historically have been. I mean, we typically think of lakes opening up here on the Kenai Lowlands in mid-May, and they were wide open by mid-April this year.
Mm-hmm.
So they probably arrived sooner, and then it's that and the fact that it was, quite a bit warmer this spring, and I think they just got going earlier.
Yeah, and we're having a warm fall. I was just talking to a friend about our skating trip we did last year on Alaska Day in the Nancy Lake system, which is now just liquid water. So it's definitely some big changes. Well, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, I'm going to ask our modeling expert, Nancy Fresco, about this warm year we had. Is this what we have to look forward to? And if so, when? Or are things coming sooner than expected? Or is it just maybe an anomaly? And we'd love to hear your questions and comments, too, if you'd like to get on the air with our experts. I'll give those phone numbers after the break so that you can get involved. So please stick with us as Hometown Alaska continues.
You're listening to Hometown Alaska from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 8 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Hometown Alaska on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back to Hometown Alaska. I'm Charles Wolforth, and our topic today is climate change in Cook Inlet. What's happening out there, and what does it mean in our neck of the woods, in this watershed that we live in, and this ocean that is sort of at our front door? I've got three experts on the show who are making me feel like I wish I had a 2 or 3 hour show because there's so much to say and they're so knowledgeable. Kind of a dream team of folks if you want to know about this topic. And we welcome your questions to get involved in this topic because it'd be very valuable to hear what you want to know and maybe some things you've observed. Maybe you've seen some changes and you're wondering about whether they're related. So if you'd like to get on the air with us, here's the phone number, 550-8433, 550-8433. Outside Anchorage, the number is 888-353-5752. And email, good way to get on the air with us, is hometown@alaskapublic.org. My three experts are Sue Marger, who is the science director for Cook Inlet Keeper, and has spent time studying salmon streams on the Kenai Peninsula and around the inlet. John Morton is a supervisory biologist at Kenai National Wildlife Refuge. And Nancy Fresco is a research professor at University of Alaska Fairbanks and helped develop this technology that allows us to kind of zoom in on individual areas in our region to look at how climate change might unfold. Nancy, before we went to the break, we were talking about this very, very exceptional year we just had. We went through all of 2014 without having 0 degree temperatures in Anchorage, almost no snowpack at the lower elevations on the Kenai Peninsula, with the result that we were just talking about with Nancy and John of fires, warm creeks, drying up creeks. And I think a lot of people are wondering, well, is that the new normal? Or is that something that's an anomaly that might be normal way off in the future?
Yeah, and I think that's one of the questions that always hovers there when we talk about climate change, when we talk about climate models, predictions, because obviously it's the extreme years, it's the, you know, the crazy weather that affects people the most, and that both is and is not climate change. It's still an extreme, it's still an outlier, but it is a foretaste of what is to come in the sense that as warming trends continue, and our models definitely show that occurring, those extreme years, those weird years, will become more and more common. So on one hand, no, it's not as if there'll never be snow in Anchorage again, or it's not as if every year will be like last winter, but that is something that we really have to prepare for as it becomes more common. And the same is true with other extreme conditions. The extremes become more extreme.
So that's one of the things that's hard to get your arms around is that winter changes so much from year to year. Some, you know, weather changes so much from year to year. How do you know when you're seeing a trend, right? Because I recall looking at some of your figures that the temperatures we were seeing last winter were not really projected as an average for a century in the future.
Yeah, and that's exactly the difficulty, the challenge, but also what makes this kind of work so interesting is that most of what we project are averages, but what people experience are not averages. You know, when you decide what clothing to put on a given day, you don't do that based on what the average temperature is for the 21st of October. But at the same time, what clothing you have in your closet is to some degree based on what the climate is. So, you know, there is the difference between weather and climate. And we, you know, using our modeling techniques and so forth, we try and make sense of that, try to make sense of the difference between the very clear trend in averages over time and then what people experience from day to day. Very true with fire as well, because if weather is variable from year to year, fire is even more variable. And yet, there are very clear trends over time showing an increase in fire in terms of frequency and intensity.
So there's no, in a sense, there's no average year. The average doesn't mean all that much. I mean, it just sort of means you could expect to have rotten skiing years 5 years out of 10 rather than 1 year out of 10. Is that sort of a good way of thinking of it?
Yeah. I mean, the average means a lot in the sense that looking at the average shows you that the change really is taking place, and it shows you how much change to expect over time. But at the same time, often the thresholds are what we worry about. When we're working with managers, when we're working with people out there on the landscape, and that might be people trying to go subsistence hunting, or people trying to go skiing, or people, any interaction with our environment is affected by both climate and weather. So these questions are hugely important.
So I want to throw this out to all three of you. Do you feel like, actually, first let me ask you a question from a listener. This is coming to us from Kendra from Chickaloon. She says she's been surprised to see that Cordova has had several summers of drought. What solutions are communities in Southeast considering related to drought? Related, are there areas that will see impacts to hydropower? And she adds that Aklutna Glacier provides some of Anchorage's drinking water, and she's wondering about glacial retreat related to that. Is that something that you've looked at, Nancy, or any of our other guests, in terms of water availability for human beings? It seems like we've got so much water around Alaska that water scarcity has never been a big problem for us. Nancy or Sue?
Sure, I can talk briefly. We have tried to model water scarcity in particular. It's a complex model because we have projections for precipitation, how much rain and snow are likely, but how much water is available, as both Sue and John have alluded to, isn't anywhere near as simple as that. It has to do with how hot it is in the summertime, how much it evaporates, how much water is taken up by plants. So you can have actually an increase in precipitation, but a much drier landscape. So it's not always intuitive.
In a sense, go ahead, John.
Yeah, Charles, I just wanted to jump in on that. I mean, down here on the Kenai, where, you know, I mentioned earlier that we've had, it's very much has dried out since 1968, and it seems to continue to be drying. And, of course, a lot of that's being driven by the warmer temperatures. But when you look at a lot of the modeling and that in fact Nancy deals with, is everything is calling for more rain down here, more precipitation, and yet we continue to dry. And I had a long conversation one time with Glenn Jude, who's now retired from University of Alaska Fairbanks, and he's the one that pointed out to me that what he thinks is going on down here is he believes the models. He believes that we are, in fact, going to get more rain down on the southern peninsula, but we will continue to dry. And the reason we will continue to dry is because that rain will come down as extreme events. And so it essentially will wash off, that precipitation will essentially wash off the landscape and not get incorporated into the available water.
That's interesting. That raises a question for me that I want to throw out to all three of you. Is that, and I know Glenn, and I remember talking to him about the very extraordinary research he was doing about how weather and insects and all these different factors influence tree growth, and then there's factors about how the trees grew and their genetics, and as we look at what Sue was saying about the fish and also what we can see about these ponds, it kind of seems like, yeah, we can kind of predict things are going to change, but the nature is so complicated that we don't really know how it's going to change until it actually happens. Do you want to take that one, Sue? I mean, do you agree with that?
Absolutely. And I think we are all learning very quickly from each other. I would say the one positive that we're getting out of this really obvious rapid change is that we have to collaborate more. We're having to do more regional studies. We need to be collaborating across disciplines more. So I'm, you know, talking to people about forest issues as well as thinking about ocean acidification and what that means for salmon. And so we are having to learn very quickly on the fly. These systems are incredibly challenging to learn about, and we haven't yet, until you are motivated to learn them, you don't. And so we are in this huge period of learning what we don't know and trying to figure out how we can best figure those pieces out in ways that are relevant for people. And I think that's something that folks on the phone too, I think, are very much about engaged communities. And this information for me, for the streams, is trying to figure out which communities in Cook Inlet are going that rely on a particular salmon stream are the most vulnerable. You know, if you have a community that's built up around the sport fishing that goes on in a particular river, and that is the most sensitive river in all of Cook Inlet, that community needs to know that. They need to be able to plan.
Is that true?
There are some systems that I have some concerns about being viable fish population.
Like, I mean, which do you feel are the sensitive rivers?
Well, so the warmest system that I've worked with is the Deshka River. But the Deshka River isn't a system that is highly developed in any way. You know, it is
highly beloved.
It's loved, and there's a lot of fishing pressure on it. But it is definitely vulnerable to being too hot for salmon in the future.
Wow.
But then a system like the Anchor River, which is not the warmest system, but it is very sensitive. And the only thing that's really saving the Anchor River is that it's down on the lower Kenai Peninsula, which is actually a lot cooler than, say, up in the Mat-Su. But the Anchor River, of course, it also has a lot of people on it. You know, there's a lot more development in that watershed, and people love the river. And so the challenge of making sure that we don't love it to death and lose the resource that everybody wants to be close to. And when you have the additive effect of climate vulnerability, that's really where I feel like this work is important to help us identify which communities do we need to work with.
Yeah, absolutely. Hometown Alaska, I'm Charles Woolforth. We're talking about climate change in the Cook Inlet region today with Sue Marger from Cook Inlet Keeper, who's just speaking. Also Nancy Fresco from the University of Alaska Fairbanks and John Morton from the Kenai National Wildlife Refuge. John, we haven't given you a chance to talk about wildlife yet. And I've also thrown this question out about sort of unexpected change and whether this is in a way, is fundamentally unpredictable as to what nature is going to do with this when we're throwing this at it. So have you seen wildlife changes taking place in the refuge due to these changing conditions?
Sure, I can give you a few examples. I mean, so here's some real data from eBird, which is an online citizen-based, recording, I guess, for lack of a better word, a database that's maintained at Cornell Labs out in New York. And so we're looking at the eBird records for the Kenai Peninsula, and this is just from the years 2007 through 2012, so just, a five-year snapshot. And in that five-year snapshot, we had 30 new species show up on the Kenai Peninsula.
Wow.
We had earlier arrival records for 33 migrant species, and we had later departure records for 38 migrant species. So birds are coming sooner, they're staying longer, and we're having new species show up on the landscape. And these are, some of these are just vagrants. It doesn't mean that they're here to stay. I mean, we had records of things like Eurasian collared dove, Heermann's gull, jacksnipes, lesser blackback gulls, those kinds of things. But that doesn't mean they're necessarily here yet to stay, but it means they're coming. And that's kind of a big deal.
Yeah.
Another one that we had that I think you might find kind of interesting, in 2002, 2003, and of course this is a little bit more anecdotal, not really data-driven, but in 2002, 2003 we had three or four avalanches that occurred in those 2 years that took out almost 200 caribou. And the reason we know that, and the reason we know that is because we had collared animals in this particular herd, and so we were able to, you know, find the carcasses after the fact. And you got to realize, 200 animals on the Kenai Peninsula at that time. We only had 1,100 caribou in total.
I was
going
to say you don't have that many to lose, right?
So we're talking about 20% of the population taken out by a few avalanches in 2002-2003. Now, that could just be a fluke, and we could write that off. But given that it wasn't just one avalanche, but it was actually three or four over a period of 2 years, I'm actually more inclined to believe that it's very possible that this the warming winters that we're getting is, are probably creating more risky avalanche conditions. And so there's a downside there to caribou, for caribou up there. On the positive end, what we've seen here since 2002, we've seen American marten expanding into the Kenai Lowlands. And I had a grad student, a guy named Andy Baldensberger, who's now up at UAF, but at that time he was from Colorado State University. He was doing this as a master's thesis. And about that time, we discovered that marten were starting to show up in trapper records for the refuge, and they have not, for all practical purposes, really haven't been on the lowlands for at least 50 years. You know, they show up every now and then, but they didn't persist. The difference here is starting around 2002, is that they were consistently in our trapper records. And so I brought this grad student on to kind of investigate, was that true? And if so, what was going on? And our initial, you know, working hypothesis coming into this was that maybe snow conditions had gotten deeper in the winter that allowed them to persist through the winter. And it all made sense back then. But the reality is when he actually got into the, you know, taking a hard look at the data, the reality, if anything, the snow depth may have actually slightly decreased. And you got to realize that marten, in the wintertime, most marten in their natural range are spending a lot of time under the snow in the subnivian zone trying to stay warm.
Mm-hmm.
And there's hardly any snow out here in the Kenai Lowlands at certain times of the winter. So we were kind of scratching our head. And the reality, and Sue mentioned this earlier, is that the winter temperatures on the Kenai have greatly increased, much more so than the average temperature. The average temperature in the last 50 years probably jumped about 2 degrees. But mid-January temperatures, on average, have jumped 7 degrees.
Wow.
And so we think what's going on here, and not only is it wintertime temperatures, but nighttime temperatures have mm-hmm. gotten even warmer. So what we think is going on here is that marten are able to survive just by using spruce cone middens and just living under logs, and they don't really need the snow to function on the
wow.
Kenai Lowlands.
So they're figuring it out along with everybody else. Say, I want to move this into another topic or move it along, because I hate to tell people about problems and not talk at all about solutions. There's a conference happening in Paris in December where 150 nations have pledged to make carbon reductions, including all the major carbon-emitting nations in the world. It's sort of the first time that everybody's gotten on board, and it seems clear that they're not going to make reduction commitments that are sufficient to solve the climate change problem, but at least they're making a step on it. Nancy, in looking at the modeling, have you had a chance to look at what the commitments are in terms of if they actually follow through with those commitments that they're going to be talking about in Paris, how that would affect your modeling? Would it mean that the numbers you're talking about would go up, down, stay the same? Would it be sort of, how do you account for, and how the models account for the idea that, well, maybe people will really address this issue?
Well, one thing we do in order to deal with that kind of uncertainty is that we don't look at just one model output. We run all our models for a range of what's called concentration pathways. They used to be called emissions scenarios. But that really ties into something that's crucial for any model, and that is realizing that while you can do a certain amount of predicting with the model, there's always going to be some built-in uncertainty, because there's that uncertainty, as you're suggesting, in terms of how well or how badly all several billion of us on the planet are going to behave, what we're going to emit. But there are other uncertainties as well in terms of how the ongoing change will affect tipping points. And that connects really strongly with what I've been hearing both John and Sue say over the past few minutes, that some of the biggest and most important changes are changes that are driven by climate but might happen quite suddenly, even though climate trends are more slow and steady. And so for us, tipping points such as that shift from a certain month being primarily snowfall to suddenly having that be primarily rainfall, that can make an enormous difference. So what we do is we address uncertainty by talking about scenarios, talking about different possible futures and how we can plan and adapt for that range of possible futures.
And so do you find what they're talking about in Paris to be hopeful in that respect, or is it not enough?
I think it's hopeful, but in a certain sense, not to sound full of gloom, nothing is enough in the sense that there's nothing that will halt the change that's ongoing. Mm-hmm. So most of what we focus on at SNAP is adaptation, saying, hopefully the agreements that are reached will be ones that will slow the change, because it's much easier to adapt to change that is a little more under control. Speaking personally, I can say I'm very hopeful about agreements being reached, but at the same time, we have to look at a range of futures and talk about adapting to what is already and inevitably going on.
Whatever they agree to is not going to solve the problem, but it might keep us from having a catastrophic sort of outcome. Yeah. Sue?
Right. The trajectories are already moving. We can't halt climate change, but we can looking to the far distant future. So certainly we can and should be attempting to slow things. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think this is a point that all of us that work in climate change are constantly battling this pessimism optimism split personality. And although I tend to be pretty optimistic about things, when you look at what's happening in Alaska, you see the same kind of struggle. You know, we are an oil-producing state, mm-hmm. And we are seeing that challenge now with our budget tied to that. But we also are starting to develop starting to see projects to develop more coal resources.
Yeah, I wanted to bring that up. This Chuitna project would be a huge coal project. And, of course, coal is the most carbon-intensive of fuels. Right. And I guess your organization's really been working against that.
Yeah, well, when you watch all this warming of your salmon streams and get serious about, how do we stop that trajectory, we have to look at fossil fuel emissions. And so the Chuitna is sort of this great example of the path and the road that we are on. And do we say, no, we're going to protect our long-term sustainable resource of salmon that should hopefully give us sustenance for a long time? Or do we invest in coal that would be exported over to China, where they would burn it, increase the fossil fuel emissions, and also mercury emissions, which then comes back to Alaska and can, we have mercury issues in our fisheries in Alaska. And a lot of that is from the coal burning in China. So we have some real choices to make here. And just as in the buildup for Paris, you feel people dragging their feet, that kicking and screaming, no, I don't want to do this, I don't want to do this, but knowing we have to. And I think Alaska is kind of at that same place. And so our organization has been trying to spread the word about what's going on over in the Chuitna watershed on the west side of Cook Inlet, and that it's not just a coal story, it's also about that adding additional stresses to our streams at this time of rapid change is not going to fare well for the salmon. And so if we remove a whole bunch of water out of the Chuitna watershed when it's already vulnerable to warming and low snowpack, that's a system that's in real real threat.
So I've read that if we burn half of the fossil fuels that are still in the earth, then we have sort of a catastrophic sort of doomsday scenario in 100 years or so. So I guess the question is, are we going to be the first ones to not burn the fossil fuels? I mean, people say, well, if we don't do it, someone else will.
Sure. So we're in this time of transition. We've got a lot of work to do to figure out how to turn the ship, and it's not going to be done without burning a lot of fossil fuels to get there. So it's
but we do have a hand in it, because it's our coal. We could say
right.
No.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the more that people see what's happening in Cook Inlet and see those changes, I think it makes it a lot more visceral for them to say, no, I'm not willing to take that risk with coal, and I want to still ski in Anchorage for as long as possible. And I think that there's a relationship between burning new coal resources and my ability to ski. So
it's taking some responsibility for it. Yeah. So here's a question from a listener, Doug, who says, should we expect to see forests of European bird cherry? I think, is that the same as Mayday tree? I don't know. Do you know, does that question make sense to you, John? About European bird cherry?
The European birch?
European bird cherry.
Well, bird cherry, yeah, the invasive, yes, that's up there in Anchorage. And it's actually down here on the Kenai now.
And is that also known as Mayday tree that has the pretty flowers in the springtime?
I don't know it by that name.
Okay.
But I do know what he's talking about. And, I think it's likely to continue spreading. And I know there's a big effort right now in Anchorage to try to remove it. The one thing about that particular invasive is it can be, you can deal with it fairly well just by yanking it out of the ground, which is a good thing.
Let's take it broader to invasives in general in forest change. I mean, one of the concerns, obviously, is if your forests are burning and your spruce are dying of spruce bark beetles, all these changes are taking place. Your sort of habitat is changing for trees, and you end up with a different forest, and maybe some of that's invasive. Is that something you see, sort of the forests turning over to different kinds of forests?
Yeah, down here in the Kenai, yeah, I'm actually very concerned about that. We have, in Alaska, there's something like 225 exotic vascular plant species, and we have at least half of those around the Kenai Peninsula.
And we just have a minute, so yeah, tell us about that.
So they're just sitting here idling on the landscape, waiting for, you know, disturbed soil to show up. And that's always a concern now with, you know, in 2014, or last year we had the Funny River fire, and this year we had the Card Street fire. And our real concern here is as these landscapes open up in response to fire or beetle kill, that interaction, is that we're going to have these exotic plants moving onto the landscape to occupy what was native plants.
And then wildlife doesn't have the same habitat that it had before, and I think the same thing is true in the waterways as we get invasives, the way it affects fish. Sue is nodding.
Yes. Yeah.
Very true for Elodea, right, Sue?
Elodea and reed canary grass, and it, you know, provides habitat for things that maybe aren't going to be as exciting to put on our plate.
Yeah. Well, this has been a very fascinating discussion for me, and I could have gone on much longer. There's more resources on the website. Inlet Keeper's got a really interesting page about future climate conditions. Check that out at alaskapublic.org. I want to thank Sue Marger, who is with Cook Inlet Keeper, for being with us, Nancy Fresco from the University of Alaska Fairbanks, and John Morton from the Kenai National Wildlife Refuge. It's been a fascinating show, and do check out those additional resources. Next week, I'll be back with you talking about the changing face of education in Anchorage. Did you know that our schools are the most diverse in the nation? In fact, we've got 29 of the 30 most diverse elementary schools. Incredible. We're going to talk about what that means for teaching and learning in Anchorage. Dave Walden was our producer today. I'm Charles Wolforth. Thanks for being with us. I'll see you next week.
Hometown Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Hometown Alaska's theme song, Lead Dog, is by Kevin Barnett from Eagle River. Learn more about Hometown Alaska and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.